Our first speaker for the second block is Edward Wilson-Ewen. He will give a review on confronting Loop Quantum Cosmology with Observations.
All right, I would like to start by thanking the organizers for giving me the opportunity to talk here. As Mercedes said, I'll be talking more about the observational status of LQC and what we've been doing along those lines. And most of my talk will focus on these four papers, but of course I'll go out and touch on a few other things as well. Now, as I think most people here already know, if we're interested in looking at quantum gravity, we expect that the effects from any quantum gravity theory will become important if the space-time curvature is very large, or if we're able to probe very small distances or go to very high energies. Now, we can't probe the Planck length with accelerators or even with cosmic rays, so it seems that our best chance of testing quantum gravity is to look at high space-time curvature regions. And we have two obvious candidates for that. The first one is black holes, and the other is the early universe. However, for astrophysical black holes, the strong gravitational field at the center is hidden by a horizon. So it's not clear if we can actually really test quantum gravity in that setting. And the other possibility, Hawking radiation, is likely to be too faint to be detected anytime soon. So it really seems as though observations of the early universe are our best option to test any theory of quantum gravity. So that's why I'll focus on here. As I'm sure everyone knows as well, we recently have gotten some data from the Planck collaboration where they've studied the cosmic microwave background in amazing detail. And beyond just the temperature anisotropy map, which they released here, we'll also be getting new information about the polarization of the CMB next year. And there's also a possibility that primordial gravitational waves will be detected in the near future. So there really is a lot of data coming out now regarding the early universe. And the hope is that we can maybe find some fingerprints from quantum gravity in it. Okay, I'm going to give a very lightning review of cosmological perturbation theory. There's a lot of details here which I have to skip, but just so you know the basics, the main variables that we're interested in are capital R, which represent curvature perturbations, and little h, which represent tensor perturbations. And these are basically our observables in cosmology. Now, the power spectrum for scalar perturbations is given as follows, and we express it in terms of k given a Fourier mode. So we take these perturbations, expand them in Fourier modes, and then the power spectrum here will be some function of the Fourier mode k. And we parameterize this dependence as some power k to the ns minus 1. And if we have scale invariant perturbations, that happens when ns is equal to 1. So that's the first thing we're interested in. The second thing we're interested in, for the purposes of my talk, is the relative amplitudes between the tensor and the scalar modes. And this is given by the tensor to scalar ratio, little r here, and it's just the ratio of these two things. And the power spectrum for tensor modes is defined in a similar way to this, although the prefactors are slightly different. But that won't be important here. The observations of the temperature anisotropies by the Planck collaboration, combined with data of the polarization from the WMAP satellite, give these results. So the scalar index is approximately 0.96, and we haven't detected any tensor modes yet, and so we have an upper bound on R of 0.12. So what we have is that we have an almost scale invariant spectrum, so NS is almost 1, but with a slight red tilt, and we have a small tensor to scalar ratio. So these are the two things which we know quite well about the CMB, and now I'm going to be interested in seeing what LQC has to say about these two things. Now, of course, it might seem a little premature to go on and talk about LQC because we already know that there exist several cosmologies that do predict scale invariance or something close to it, and that also predict a small value of R. And three that I'll be talking about today are inflation, the matter bounce, and the ekparotic universe. However, these three scenarios all have slightly different predictions. And as observations become more precise, it seems likely that one scenario is likely to become favored over the others. So my goal today is to ask, how does LQC change the predictions in these scenarios if we include these quantum gravity effects? Are there any corrections, which of course may be small, which could be detectable and which could deviate from our expectations from general relativity? And so this is my goal today, to see how LQC modifies the standard predictions, especially in the matter bounds in the ekpyrotic universe. And for this talk, I'll really focus on Hilami corrections. Of course, there are also inverse triad corrections and some other things that are interesting to look at, but here I'm just going to focus on the Hilami effects. Okay, so this is the goal of the talk. And in order to go through it, these are the next steps which I'll follow. So first, I'm going to show you how it's possible to deal with perturbations in loop quantum cosmology. And then I'll consider these two specific cosmologies in LQC and see how they modify, if at all, the predictions that you would have if you'd only trusted general relativity and try to determine predictions from that setting. And then after that, I'll conclude. Do you have another laser pointer that I can use? Or it seems to be dying. Oh, no, it's back. Sorry. All right. So I'll start by explaining how we can study perturbations in loop quantum cosmology, and specifically to incorporate Hilami corrections and see how they modify the equations of general relativity. So just a brief review. So in loop quantum cosmology, of course, we're motivated by loop quantum gravity. So we're going to use the same variables, and we're going to use the same techniques that have been used in loop quantum gravity. And the basic idea is that we start with Hilami's of the connection and areas. So when we want to define the Hamiltonian constraint operator, what we do is we have to express the field strength operator in terms of Hilami's. And then, as John explained in the previous talk, what you can do is that you can kind of parachute in the value of the area gap when you shrink the area around which you take the Hilami. So what you do is that you're taking the Hilami around a loop with an area with the smallest area eigenvalue of loop quantum gravity, and that is how you get your Hamiltonian constraint operator. Now, this is something that you can do for homogeneous cosmologies, and it's been done for a lot of different settings for both the Friedmann universes and the Bianchi universes, but it's very hard to use these techniques in order to treat inhomogeneities for a variety of technical reasons, which I don't really want to get into here. What we do instead is that what we can do is go to split the inhomogeneities and the background and use loop techniques to quantize the background, and then FOC techniques to quantize the inhomogeneities around the background. And these are called hybrid approaches, and they've been used to study the Gaudi model, for example. And also, you can do it to study cosmological perturbation theory around Friedmann universe as well. And Ivan has talked about this, and I expect there'll be more talks about this also later on during this conference. However, this isn't the approach that I want to follow. Instead, I'd like to try and do a loop quantization of everything, background and perturbations together. And one way that you can try and do this is to generalize a separate universes approach to LQC. And the basic idea is that you take your inhomogeneous space-time and you split it up into cells. And you assume that each cell is homogeneous. And then, if you do some gauge fixing, it turns out that you can take each cell as a Friedmann universe. And when you have a Friedmann universe, you know how to use loop techniques to quantize it. So you can do that. Then, once that's been done, you have to worry about interaction terms between neighboring cells. But luckily, it turns out that's relatively easy to take care of. So we get a little bit lucky in the sense that the interaction terms are easy, and the only thing that we really have to worry about is the loop quantization of the individual cells. So we can do that. I'm going to skip a lot of the details here. It's quite technical. But the end result is that if you have states with small perturbations, the scalar and Diffeo constraints for each cell, so these are two constraints, and the cells are denoted by the vector z here, weakly commute with the Hamiltonian. So we do have a consistent quantum theory that includes loop effects, loop quantum cosmology effects, for not only the background, but also the perturbations around the background. OK, so now that we have this, we'd like to use it. So let's try and do this. So in the Friedman universes, we know that there exist effective equations which provide an excellent approximation to the dynamics of sharply peaked states at all times, including at the bounce. So even when the quantum gravity effects are at the strongest, the effective equations still hold. Now, we haven't studied the quantum dynamics of the lattice LQC that I introduced on the previous slide in enough detail to know if the effective equations will hold here as well. But we'll make the we'll assume that they will. But of course, this is something that remains to be checked and has to be checked in order to make sure that the results which I present later are indeed correct. Now, if you make this assumption, you can introduce a new variable z, which depends only on the background. And then the variable v equal to z times r, if you recall, r is the curvature perturbation, which I introduced earlier on in the talk, has a very simple equation of motion, which is the following one here. And for those of you who aren't experts in cosmology, this is a very simple modification to the Mukhanov-Sasaki equation, which is exactly the same thing except without the term in red. So what LQC does is that it adds this additional term, this red term, which becomes important when the energy density of the background becomes comparable to the critical energy density of LQC. And just for notational purposes, here the primes denote derivatives with respect to the conformal time. OK, so now we have this effective equation. Let's use it and see what we can do with it. But before going on to that point, I just want to make a few comments. So the first one concerns the robustness of this equation. So I want to point out that it's possible to obtain this exact same equation following a completely different approach. And this is the anomaly freedom approach. And the idea there is that you work purely at the effective level. And what you do is that you add correction functions in order to represent either holonomy or inverse triad effects. And then you look at the constraint algebra, and you make sure that the constraints close. And this was done first for inverse triad effects. But you can also do it for holonomy corrections for perturbations around a flat Friedman background. And you find exactly the same equation that we get in lattice LQC. So what I find is very nice is that we get the same result coming from two different approaches. So I think this is a nice sign of robustness. Now, another comment that I want to make concerns the comments about signature change. So what you can do when you go through this anomaly freedom approach is that you can check to see how the Poisson brackets between the effective constraints happen. And so it turns out that you get a 1 minus 2 rho over rho c in front of the Diffeo constraint when you look at the Poisson bracket between two scalar constraints. So if you recall from the full theory that the sign in front of this depends on whether you're dealing with a Lorentzian spacetime or Euclidean spacetime. So this tends to indicate that perhaps the spacetime becomes Euclidean at the bounce because this sign changes at the bounce point. And the results from a while ago by Heumann, Kukash, and Teitelboim seem to argue that this must happen. However, I'm not convinced of this for the following reason. We can look directly at the scalar constraint, which in loop variables has the following form, and notice the S which appears in the constraint. So you can ask, does this S term change at the bounce point? And the easiest way to check this is just to go to the flat non-zero lambda Friedman model. And so the three curvature is zero in this case, so we don't have to worry about this term. We only have this term and this term. And so we would expect there to be an overall sign change between the resulting EEF term and the cosmological constant term. But we find that this is not the case. So it seems clear to me that something is happening. The fact that the sign here is changing is indicative of something, although I'm not really sure what, to be honest. But my point here is that I'm not convinced that it's becoming Euclidean. So I think we need to think a little bit more carefully about this and see what other things might happen here. Another possibility is that when this term changes sign is also when gravity in LQC becomes repulsive. So maybe these two things are linked. So anyways, I think there's a lot more that's required we should think about in this setting. And finally, I just want to comment on why the results of Heumann-Kukash and Teitelboim don't hold here. And my guess, I haven't checked this, but my guess is that it's because we're working with truncated constraints. So in order to apply their results, you'd have to work with the full constraints. And here, of course, we're dealing with perturbations. So we only have the perturbed constraints. So maybe if it were possible in some settings to work with a full constraint, we would see something different. So anyways, this is something to be looking into in the future. All right. So I went on a couple of side issues here, but now I want to return to the main goal of my talk, which is to look at the Halonery-corrected Mukunov-Sasaki equation and try and determine how LQC effects can modify the standard predictions that we have in most cosmologies. Now, as I've already mentioned, we have several cosmologies which seem to agree very well with observations of the CMB, notably inflation, the matter bounce, and the ekparotic universe. A lot of people have worked on various aspects of inflation. We heard a talk about it earlier today, actually two talks about it earlier today, and we'll probably have several more talks throughout the conference, so I won't focus on inflation so much. Instead, I'll focus on the other two, but of course, it's very important to understand what's happening with inflation as well. So let me briefly review what these two alternatives to inflation are. Inflation is quite well known, but the matter bounce in the ekparotic universe, less so. And they're both alternatives to inflation, where you get scale invariant perturbations during a contracting universe rather than during the expanding branch, as it happens in inflation. Now, of course, if you get scale invariant perturbations during the contracting branch, you need to have a bounce so that they can go through to the expanding branch where we live today. So both of these models require a bounce, which appears naturally in LQC. So for this reason, I think that they both seem to fit in quite nicely with what we know about LQC. But now, of course, we want to figure out whether LQC modifies their predictions in a way which is consistent with what we see in the CMB or not. So let's start with the matter bounce. So the matter bounce scenario is a universe which is thus dominated, so the pressure is equal to zero, which means that the energy density goes as 1 over the scale factor cubed. And what it does is that it turns quantum vacuum fluctuations into scale invariant fluctuations, just like an exponentially expanding universe does. And this duality was first noticed by Wands. Now, at first, it might not have seemed too interesting, because what do we care if there are scale invariant perturbations going into a big crunch singularity? But Fanelli and Brandenburger noticed that if you have a bounce, there are some continuity arguments from general relativity that give some hope that the perturbations of the expanding post-bounce era will also be scale invariant. Now, of course, there's no guarantee that this is the case, because they're using arguments from general relativity. And we don't expect general relativity to hold during the bounce. But nonetheless, the hope is that maybe if we have some quantum gravity, these arguments will hold, and perhaps we will have the scale invariant perturbations that we want in the expanding branch. And so, of course, in order to understand the specifics of this, we need to understand exactly how the bounce occurs. And we can do that in loop quantum cosmology, and I'll show you exactly how. So let's start with the classical part of the matter bounce. So we're going to start well before the bounce, when we can really trust general relativity. So we have a large contracting universe, which is thus dominated. And you can solve the Mukunov-Sasaki equation, and it gives this here. And this here is the Hankel function. And we, of course, when we solve the differential equation, we have to choose the numerical prefactors. And they're chosen here so that the variable v has quantum vacuum fluctuations at early times, or as eta goes to minus infinity. And here, eta is the conformal time. So what we see is that we can now take the asymptotics of the Hankel function for a small argument. So as your modes exit the Hubble radius, then this term becomes small, and the Hankel function, when expanded, has this form. What we see is that we have a constant term, and we have a scale invariant term. So this term, if you remember the definition for the power spectrum, which goes as k cubed times the norm of rk squared, So the dominant term here will be this term, so k to the minus 3, once you square this, times k cubed, and so you'll get k to the 0. So this term will be scale invariant. And what's important is that this term is growing. So as you approach the bounce, this term will become more and more and more important. OK, so this is the classical story. What does LQC have to say about this? Well, in the long wavelength limit, the Mukunov-Sasaki equation has this form. And the solution to this differential equation is the following one. All right? And for the LQC solution for a dust-dominated universe, the function z has this form where I've dropped the numerical prefactors. And so we can solve this explicitly. So what we're really interested in is r. That's the curvature perturbation. And that's just v divided by z. So if we have v, we can just divide out z here, divide out z here. So we're going to have a constant term and then a time-dependent term. And this is what we have here. And I've already plugged in the k-dependence, because if you go back here, you know that this is the k-dependence it has to have before the bounce. Right? This is the classical solution, so of course the two have to agree. So the constant mode goes as k to the 3 halves, and the time-dependent mode goes as k to the minus 3 halves. And that's what I say right here. Now what we're interested in is what happens after the bounce. And so after the bounce, we find that we have this new dependence on the curvature perturbation. We have this extra term which appears here. And that's because of the asymptotic behavior of arctan. So if you have arctan of x going to minus infinity, that goes as minus pi over 2, so it cancels out this term, plus terms of 1 over t, basically. However, when you go towards t going to plus infinity, or large t, simply, then you'll get plus pi over 2. So these two terms will add up, and you'll get an extra constant term here. And that's the source of this new constant term of k to the minus 3 halves. Now, this is essential, because you have this term, which is also scale invariant, but now we're in an expanding universe. So this eta cubed is going to damp this term considerably. And this term will not be relevant for observational purposes, because as the universe starts expanding again, it'll become smaller and smaller and smaller. Instead, we have this constant term here, which will be relevant for observation. So it's very important that we get this new term here. Now, the other thing is that we're interested in long wavelength modes. We're looking at cosmological scales. So this means that wavelengths are very long, or small k. So for small k, this is the dominant term. We can completely neglect this term. This term is much, much larger. So what we find is that in the matter bounds, we do indeed get a scale invariant spectrum for curvature perturbations. All right. Now, I don't have time to go through the same procedure for tensor perturbations, but it can be done. And I do want to point out that the corrections to the tensor modes are slightly different. But nonetheless, the procedure can be followed in a relatively straightforward way. And the results for the matter bounds in LQC are the following. First, we start with initial vacuum fluctuations long in the past. In a contracting universe, they become scale invariant. And the dominant contribution to the constant mode in the expanding universe is also scale invariant. One important point is that the scalar and tensor perturbations have the same tilt. This is different from inflation. In inflation, the scalar and tensor modes have different tilts in general. So this is one way that you can tell the two scenarios apart. So this is an important point. The other thing is that in LQC, the tensor to scalar ratio is very small. R is about 10 to the minus 3. And finally, in order for the amplitude of the scalar perturbations to match observations, we need the critical energy density of LQC to be about 10 to the minus 9 times the Planck energy density. Now, one thing which I think is a nice feature of this model is the very small tensor to scalar ratio. Typically, in matter bounce models, the value of R is expected to be 1/4 or even larger. And that is ruled out observationally. Recall that there's a bound on the tensor to scalar ratio of 0.12, basically. So most models of the matter bounce are ruled out. But in LQC, it's not, because the spectrum is naturally suppressed, precisely because the fact that the LQC corrections to Mukunov-Sasaki equation for tensor modes is different to what it was for scalar modes. One of the weaknesses is that typically we expect the critical energy density to be around the Planck energy density. And if we want to match observations, here it has to be considerably smaller. But here I do want to point out that, of course, we haven't yet derived LQC from loop quantum gravity. So it might turn out that the critical energy density is a lot smaller than we expect. But in any case, this is something that we need to be aware of. So this is what we can say about the matter bounce. And we can also look at the ekparotic universe, which is a separate possibility for generating scale invariant perturbations in a contracting pre-Big Bang phase. Now, this is different because we have a slowly contracting space-time. So we have a scale factor. So it's negative, of course. The time is negative, so we start at minus infinity. And it contracts very slowly, where this p is some power much, much less than 1. And what we typically have is, as a matter field, are one or two scalar fields with some potentials, which are chosen so that it mimics a perfect fluid with a constant equation of state, omega, that has this form. Now, since p is very, very small, this means that we have an ultra-stiff matter field. Now, when you look at the predictions in this setting for this contracting universe, you can find that the Bardeen potential, which is one of the observables in cosmology, becomes scale invariant. And you have, again, as we had earlier, you have a growing mode in the Bardeen potential, which is scale invariant. However, the co-moving curvature perturbation does not have a scale invariant term. So it's a little odd. What should we expect? Should we expect it to be scale invariant or not? And so I'll come back to this on the very next slide. Another important point is that if you have more than one scalar field, as you have in most of these models, then you also have entropy perturbations due to the fact that the matter fields don't necessarily have higher energy density at the same places. So since they can fluctuate differently, you can also have entropy perturbations. And it turns out that these do also become scale invariant in the contracting branch in the ekparotic universe. So first, we'll look at the case when you have a single scalar field, and then we'll go on to the case where you have two. So as I said earlier, the Bardeen potential contains a growing mode, which is scale invariant. Now we want to know, well, what happens on the other side of the bounce? And I won't go through the details here, but the main result is that we can do the exact same procedure as before, solve the LQC Mukhanov-Sasaki equation, and you find that you get a new term, which is this term here. So we still have this term. So we have these two terms before the bounce, and after the bounce, we have these three terms. This term is the same, this term is the same, and this is a new term. Now, this last term decays rapidly in the expanding universe, so it's not relevant for observations. Between these two terms, which are relevant, the dominant one is k to the minus 1/2, and this has a blue spectrum. So the single scalar field case is ruled out in LQC. It is not viable. We can look at the two scalar field case as well. And this is different because now we have the entropy perturbations, which can play an important role. And so if we assume that the entropy perturbations are initially in a quantum vacuum state, then as the bounce is approached, again, you have a growing mode, which is scale invariant. Now, if you go through the equations of motion for perturbations, just in general relativity, you'll see that entropy perturbations source the curvature perturbations. So you'll have some function, r dot is proportional to entropy perturbations. So it's possible to use the perturbations in the entropy field and transfer them into the curvature perturbation. And this can be done. And when this is done, you actually pick up constant terms in the curvature perturbation, one from each one. And the amplitudes here depend on the time at which this transfer is done. But the important point is that you have one which is scale invariant. And this happens already in the contracting branch before the bounce. So far, to get here, I haven't used LQC at all. This is entirely classical. But now we can use LQC to go through the bounce and see what form the perturbations have on the other side. And what we find is that we get these terms. We have the same four terms plus a new additional term here. But the new additional term is small compared to the scale invariant term. And so we can neglect it. And we're left with the scale invariant term. And so when you have two scalar fields and you have entropy perturbations present, you do find that the curvature perturbations are also scale invariant, assuming that the entropic mechanism happens before the bounds. So let me recap the results for the ekparotic model. So if you have a single scalar field in the ekparotic scenario, this is not viable in LQC. It's ruled out by observations. However, the two-scalar field realization of the ekparotic universe agrees with observations. We have a nearly scale invariant power spectrum and no tensor modes. So here, if any tensor modes are detected, this one is also ruled out. Now, I haven't told you what the exact values for the tilt and the amplitude are, and that's because they depend on the specific form of the potentials that you use for the scalar field. There's some freedom there, and depending on what precise potentials you choose, you'll get different tilts and different amplitudes. But the point is that it's possible to get ones that are in agreement with observations. And finally, I think an important point is that the dominant term in the constant mode of the curvature perturbations can be determined in the classical regime before the bounds. So here, LQC doesn't affect the predictions coming from the classical setting. All right, so let me conclude. So I started off by showing you how we can get the LQC effective equations with holonomy corrections by working on a lattice of homogeneous cosmologies. We can use these effective equations to see how perturbations travel through the bounds, both in the matter bounce scenario and the ekparotic universe. What we find is that the matter bounce and the ekparotic universe, so long as there are two scalar fields, are both in agreement with the results from Planck. And if we observe tensor perturbations with a tensor to scalar ratio of the order or greater than 1%, it would rule both of these cosmologies out. Of course, inflation would not be ruled out, so that would still be a possibility. And finally, I just want to point out a few things which remain to be done. I said already there's been a lot of work on inflationary models, but most of them have considered a phi squared potential. I think it's important to go beyond that. And it's also interesting to look at non-Gaussianities and also including the presence of anisotropies as we approach the bounce, because we do expect anisotropies to be very important at the bounce point. So I leave all this for the future. So thank you for your attention.
Time for questions.
So thank you very much for this very interesting talk. Just a question. I mean, if we need in the matter bounds modification the critical density to be so low, is it still LQC? Because I thought that the prediction of the value of LQC maybe can vary by a factor of 10, but not by such a huge factor. And second question, non-Gaussianities, I mean, don't you think it's already quite strongly disfavoring ekparotic models? I mean, do you expect that LQC modification could lower the amount of expected non-Gaussianities?
Okay, so I'll address the first one first. So for the matter bounce, I agree that having such a small critical energy density is problematic. A priori, I would expect the energy density to vary within, as you say, maybe one or two orders of magnitude of the Planck energy density. But until we actually derive it from LQG, we might be surprised. So I think we have to be aware of that limitation. But nonetheless, at this point, I don't think it's ruled out. For the ekparotic model, I'm not an expert on ekparotic models. But my understanding is that statements in the Planck collaboration papers regarding non-Gaussianities depends very specifically on one particular entropic mechanism, which gives a particular type of non-Gaussianities. And I believe there are arguments that say that if you have different types of transfers, then you'd have different types of non-Gaussianities, and those are not ruled out. So I think the argument is that they're saying that that would be akin to looking only at the phi squared potential for inflation and then saying that it's in trouble. But I'm not an expert on that, so you have to.
So do I use these lattice ideas?
Yes.
So one expects that when you take the size of the lattice going to infinity, inhomogeneities disappear. Mm-hmm. So does this size, how this size appears in your equations and in your predictions?
Okay. So how that works is that, so today we see some modes that have some wavelength. And then if we know how the background behaves, we'll know that they had some minimal length at the bounce point, depending on the background. So for inflation, it'd be much smaller. For the matter bounce, it'd be much larger. And so then we want to partition the visible universe into cells so that we can describe these perturbations at that level. And so in that sense, what I'd say today, we want to see what the smallest wavelengths are that we can see in the sky. And we want to choose a lattice today so that the resolution agrees with what we see then. And then we can bring that back towards the bounce and see what happens. Now, we run into trouble if the volume of each cell approaches the Planck volume. And so for inflation, I would be a little bit worried about using this setting. But for the matter bounce and for the ekparatic universe, each cell for the resolution today still remains much larger than the Planck volume, so we don't run into that problem.
That size appears explicitly in your equation as a parameter and in your predictions?
No, it disappears
from the equations. And why it disappears? Because I would expect that if you take the limit of this size going to infinity, everything should disappear.
So. Right. So if you, so the simplest way to see it is that, so you have your quantum theory, which is discrete, and there the parameter definitely appears. And then you can look at the effective theory. All right. And then again, the parameter appears. Then you can take the continuum limit of the effective theory, and then it disappears. So I'm using the continuum limit here. Now, if you were going to do it the full quantum theory, then it would still remain at the end. But the hope is that if you choose something which is fine enough, the results will be independent of it. But that has to be checked in the full quantum theory, which I haven't done yet.
Yeah. Are there more questions? If not, let's thank Eduard again.
Thank you.
Our next speaker is Julian Grain. Okay, Julian is going to speak today about loop quantum cosmology in the cosmic microwave background.
Thanks. So everybody hears me? Yeah. So what I want to discuss in this talk is the link between the modelization of the primordial universe in loop quantum cosmology and our main observable of the primordial universe, the CMB. The CMB anisotropies. And I want to discuss that really from the observational viewpoint. So in a sense, it will be a talk on classical cosmology, but the initial conditions of these talks are set by the LQC framework. So let me just briefly remind the strategy, if we want to relate LQC prediction and CMB. Obviously, the starting point is a LQC model of the universe. And a model of the universe, it always implies two things. The evolution of the background, that is the evolution of the isotropic and homogeneous part of the universe. And you have here an artist representation of that. So the universe is before in a contracting phase. Then it experiences the quantum boons, and then it enters in its classical expanding phase, starting with inflation. And the second ingredient in modelizing the universe is to describe its own inhomogeneities. And those inhomogeneities, they are usually described in a perturbative setting, so we usually call them cosmological perturbation. And this is really an important point to have access to the perturbation, obviously because the universe is not, strictly speaking, isotropic and homogeneous. It's only statistically isotropic and homogeneous. But it's also our main observable. We observe the universe, I mean, we set constraint on the universe by observing the cosmological perturbations, that is, the CMB anisotropies or the distribution of large-scale structures and galaxies. So this is really the quantity we want to compute. This is the perturbations. And the idea is just the following. During contraction and quantum boons, and also during inflation, the cosmological perturbations are amplified, and at the end of inflation, we have, let's say, a realization of inhomogeneities, of tiny inhomogeneities in the universe, and they are usually described by their power spectrum. And just amount the power in the perturbation as a function of their wave number. And then, from that, we can use the Boltzmann equation in a FLRW universe to compute the CMB angular power spectra. And those CMB angular power spectra, they can be extracted from the observation of the CMB. And then we can just loop back, that is, using the CMB to set constraint on that primordial power spectrum. And what I want to discuss is precisely those two arrows. First, from the power spectrum, primordial power spectrum, to the angular power spectrum, and then how we can loop back. So in this talk, I will consider, let's say, a restricted framework in the following sense. I will just consider some primordial power spectrum obtained using holonomy corrections. I will not consider the case of inverse volume correction due to LQC, but you can see, no, not the talk, but there are some papers by Martin Boyoval which show some constraint on inverse volume correction using the CMB. And I will also assume the following small scale limit for the primordial power spectrum, that is, assume that when k tends to infinity, the primordial power spectrum predicted in LQC is identical to the primordial power spectrum predicted in a purely inflationary model. So if you want to see other examples where this is not this condition is not met, you can have a look at the poster by Boris. So let's start with the first arrow, going from the primordial power spectrum to the angular power spectrum of the CMB. And what we use is the line of sight solution of the Boltzmann equation in a perturbed FLRW universe. So this gives you the CMB angular power spectrum as an integral over k of the primordial power spectrum, which is the source of the anisotropies of the CMB, convolved, in a sense, with the something called the transfer function. And in fact, those two ingredients probe two different parts of the cosmic history. The transfer function, it probes the end of inflation to today. And it considers many, let's say, all the physics of the primordial plasma. Now, if we want to probe inflation, this is, and boons and contraction, this is via the primordial power spectrum. So the primordial power spectrum, it probes inflation in the standard scenario and also contraction and the boons in our case. I just want to mention that if you want to use this line of sight approach, you have to break the history of the universe in two parts. So just the two parts I mentioned. After the end of inflation, in your model, it's mandatory that the cosmic history is identical to what we obtain in standard cosmology, but this is at least the minimum we can ask of our LQC model. But it is also important that before the end of inflation, that is also during the boons and the contracting phase, there is no physics like radiative transfer, particle production, and this guarantees that all the information of those three phases are captured by the primordial power spectrum. And usually in the model which have been presented since this morning, this is guaranteed because we consider that before the end of inflation, the matter content is completely dominated by a scalar field. So now that we know how to go from primordial power spectrum to angular power spectrum, obviously, in the LQC framework, there is no reason for this primordial power spectrum to be identical to what is predicted in pure inflation. And we can wonder how a distortion of this primordial power spectrum induced by LQC translates into distortion of the CMB angular power spectrum. And in fact, you can have a rough idea of how it will be distorted by considering two important scales. So the first one is the Hubble scale today. This is just the largest scale you can observe today in the universe. And it corresponds to a wave number of 2.3 × −4 megaparsec minus 1. This just means that modes with a wave number smaller than that, we cannot observe them today. There is another typical scale, which is set by LQC. And I mean, in the restricted models that I considered, in fact, it's universal. At the time of the boons, this scale is just given by the square root of 8 pi g rho c. And this means what? For modes smaller than Kastar, LQC affects the shape of the primordial power spectrum, and for modes greater than Kastar, we just have the standard inflationary prediction. So if we want to be able to observe the LQC with the CMB, it's necessary that Kastar is bigger than KH, but today. And this value, this physical wave number, is set at the time of the boon. So this means that you have to take into account the expansion, the entire expansion of the universe from the boons to today. And the condition is just that K star at the time of the boons divided by KH today is greater than the exponential, the number of E-fold from today, from the boons to today. And, well, let's give rough estimation. K star is the order of 1 over the Planck length. And this means that if you want to be able to observe LQC effect, the number of E-fold should be smaller than 70 to 90, it depends on the precise number of E-fold during reheating. It also depends on the precise number of E-fold between the boons and the beginning of inflation. But this just gives, rough number. Now let's just imagine that this value of Kastar can be falls in the observational range. Then the distortion of the CMB angular power spectrum will be at a given value of the multiples, which is just given by roughly the ratio of the of Kastar today divided by KH today. So this is once again a rough estimation, but which assumes that the transfer function is a kind of Dirac, which is untrue. It has a width, but in fact it gives you very good order of magnitude. So let's just take an example now with more precise computation, that is, so here is just an example. We have here the primordial power spectrum, so for tensor perturbation. The blue curve is just what you obtain in inflation, and the green curve is something you can obtain in a, let's say, toy model for LQC. And here, the value of K star is roughly at 10 to −2 megaparsec minus 1. And how this distortion translates into distortion of the CMB angular power spectrum. So this is shown on the right part. Once again, the blue curve is what you obtain in pure inflation. And the green curve is what you obtain using this green primordial power spectrum for two values of K star. So if K star is 10 to −2 megaparsec minus 1, this boost here is translated into a boost roughly at L star equal 100. And obviously, the suppression here is translated into a suppression here at low multiples. Now, if K star is equal to 10 to −4 megaparsec minus 1, then it's smaller than KH, but still we see the tail of this boost, which is translated into a boost at low multiples. So this was going from the primordial power spectrum to the angular power spectrum. Now let's do the opposite. And the first thing I want to say is that what are the major outputs of a CMB experiment? We can think of the CMB maps. This is the one obtained for Planck, for temperature and isotropy. We can also think of the angular power spectra estimated from those maps. So this is the red point, once again obtained by Planck. So for sure, it's mandatory, but it's not sufficient. There is another very important output, which is, let's say, the likelihood function. That is, in fact, in CMB, when you set constraint, you just set constraint on the, you just say how likely is your model. So how does it work? what you want to have is the what is called the posterior probability. That is the probability of your model knowing the data that is the observed CL. Now, this, in fact, is just the probability of the values that the cosmological parameters may admit knowing the observed CL. And why I want to present that? Because when you compute this posterior probability, there is always a theoretical framework which is assumed at some point. So for example, if you take the Planck or the WMAP paper, and it states that, let's say, the mass of the inflaton field is 10 to minus 6. This assumes that the primordial power spectrum is given by a power law. Now, if you change the shape of the primordial power spectrum, there is no reason for this value to be still the same. Because, in fact, you change what is called the prior probability of your theory, which will change, obviously, the posterior probability. And therefore, there is no reason to, a priori, no reason for the mass, for example, the mass of the inflaton field to be the same value if you change the shape of the primordial power spectrum. Obviously, it will not change by order of magnitude, but it may change. So you need a bit of flexibility in your model, the value of the parameter you will try to explore. And in fact, this is because what is really probed with CMB, it's not the background evolution. It's the primordial power spectrum. And then those constraints, you translate them into constraints on, let's say, the mass of the inflaton field, assuming a class of model. Well, I'll skip that. Let's just have a brief look at the results obtained by Planck. So this is the temperature angular power spectra. The dots are what is obtained from the data, and the green curve is the best fit model. And this best fit assumes inflation, that is a power law for the primordial power spectrum. For L greater than 50, there is very good agreement. For L below 50, there is, let's say, a tension at 2.5 sigma. So one can wonder if we deform the shape of the primordial power spectrum to have a better fit, a global better fit that is still very good here and better, a better fit in this low L region. But this form of the C's of L's set constraint on how you can modify the shape of the primordial power spectrum. So first of all, the typical scale should be given by Kastar over KH today of the order of 50. And obviously, we want that the primordial power spectrum to be identical to what we obtain in inflation for K greater than 50 times KH. Then this ensures to not to change here. And here, we want to modify it, but we see that we have a slight suppression. So what we want is for mods K smaller than 50 times KH to have, let's say, a slight suppression of the primordial power spectrum, if we want to have a better fit. So we can implement this constraint, and we'll just finish with a slide. So here, I just plot the value of the scale of LQC at the time of the boons in Planck unit as a function of the number of e-folds from the boons to today. So this line here, it just corresponds to K star over KH equal 50. For higher values of KH, we will modify too much the C's of L's, and this will be rapidly excluded by Planck. The second line here is K star over KH of the order of 1. If it's smaller, we do not see any difference between LQC and pure inflation. And in fact, the range where we can, let's say, observe effect of LQC, possibly observe effect of LQC, which are not also excluded, this is given by this band. And if we take 1 over L Planck for K star, this is this region, this roughly corresponds to a number of e-folds between 60 to 70. Obviously, this is all order of magnitude, just to give you intuitive reasoning to go from P of K to C of L and vice versa. At the end of the day, what should be really done is to go through all these posterior probabilities to have quantitative results. But this has currently been done for inverse volume correction, partially done with holonomy correction. Thank you.
Any question? Okay. If there are no questions, let's thank the speaker again. Our next speaker is Linda Linsenfors.
Do you hear me?
Yeah.
Good.
Okay, so Linda will tell us about duration of slow roll inflation as a prediction of effective loop quantum cosmology.
Thank you for letting me talk here. I'm going to use a model which is a flat, homogeneous, isotropic universe with effective holonomy corrections, which give me this modified Friedmann equation. And in this universe, I'm putting an inflaton field with a phi squared potential, and which gives me this equation of motion, this one. And with only those two equations and one simple assumption, I will predict how long slow roll inflation is. And the reason why it's interesting to know how long slow roll inflation is, firstly, because it has to be long enough to, otherwise it doesn't work as a model to explain the things we want inflation to explain. And secondly, it's very interesting to know how much has the universe expanded since the bounds to set the probable window on all those perturbations that we have heard mentioned in several talks today. But I will just start to look at the classical picture so you can really see what is different classically and in effective loop quantum cosmology. So this is the phase space trajectory of the inflaton field in the normal GR. So this line here is slow roll inflation. And this point here, there's some small oscillations here in the middle, is the reheating where the inflaton decays into the matter we have today. And assuming I don't have a preferred model of quantum gravity, then I would say, okay, I have general relativity. It probably breaks down at the Planck density here. I have no idea what's happened at the Planck density, so it makes sense to just put some random initial conditions here. And this is basically what has been done before in loop quantum cosmology, only we don't use the Planck density, we use the critical density, which is slightly smaller with the current prediction, but same order of magnitude, so no real difference. And you see that all those curves lead to inflation, but still has to be long enough. And the number of e-folds can be easily calculated from the value of the field as the onset of inflation. So I used a very large mass here just for visibility, but the mass suggested by the W map is 10 to the minus 6. The Planck doesn't really favor this potential at all. It doesn't rule it out, but I mean, it also we have to have a small mass here for it to work with observations. So you can see that even if inflation starts very, very close to this point in this phase space diagram, we still have long enough inflation. So if you put your initial conditions around the Planck density, you need lots and lots of fine tuning not to get long enough inflation. And this is not unique for loop quantum cosmology. It's generic for any model that happens at the Planck density. But we also get completely arbitrary length from inflation. I mean, this is, if the inflation starts here with the mass 10 to the minus 6, you get about 10 to the 12 number of e-poles, which is just ridiculously long. So, loop quantum cosmology then. Here we have the pre-bounds solutions. Here we have the post-bounds. The big circle here is the critical density where the bounds happens. Slower on inflation and reheating. And as you see, it's very similar to the classical case. There's some differences around the bounds, but if you put initial conditions at the bounds, what I told you in the classical case, it's still true. But I have another suggestion, which is that we shouldn't put initial conditions at the bounds. We should put initial condition at the beginning, which is here. So I have no idea what's going on here. I don't know what the inflaton field is. It might be created somewhere here in the middle by some inverse reheating. It might have existed forever. But it doesn't really matter because my predictions would turn out it's not very important exactly what's going on here. So now we'll zoom in on this point. This is exactly the same trajectories that I showed you before. They're right on top of each other. And you see here, there's an oscillation. This is not the natural distribution in this regime. So if I start somewhere here, I would want to put some flat probability distribution over this oscillation angle. And this is what that looks like. And as you see, the length of inflation is no longer arbitrary. So I only change the probability distribution. So this is, if you start here, you can still get all of these solutions that happens out here. The difference is you need lots and lots of fine tuning. And since inflation is all about avoiding fine tuning for the initial conditions of the universe, we shouldn't reintroduce this. So this is the shape that we will get. And so I want to show you how this scales with M. So here, no, this was the wrong way. I think, no. Ah, yeah. I'm ahead of myself. Yes, so this is just the same plot as before. I zoomed out a bit to fit these expressions. N is the number of E folds of inflation. And to show you how this scales with M, so this is when I change M to 10 to the minus 3. I mean, I want to get down to 10 to the minus 6 eventually. This is not empty. The solution is just very, very close to the y-axis. Maybe you can see that the y-axis looks a bit thicker down here. So you see that from having all the possibilities of length of slow inflation up to here, and narrow it down to something that is very, very close to this y-axis and around this value. So I mean, equations that we use, they don't have exact analytical solutions. We have very good analytical approximations. We are aware of what's happening everywhere. But I still need to use numerics to get this. So this is from analytics, calculated from analytical approximations. And the plots that I show you is numerical solutions. And to get more, why don't they, precise result, the next step is just to do lots and lots of numerical simulations and just add up the distribution. And so to do that, I can't just say I have about a flat. Why can't I? Ah. So, yeah, so I need to specify exactly what is my initial conditions. And it's not one initial conditions, it's a set of initial conditions with a probability distribution. And naively, I would say that, I just choose some small energy density. And then this delta here is the angle, goes from 0 to 2 pi over this angle between the kinetic and the potential energy. But if I do that, I get something that looks like this in the beginning. And also, so it's not really even, and it will also depend on the exact value of rho zero. So I have to modify this a bit to this. And the very nice thing with these initial conditions, that if I put a flat probability distribution over this angle delta, then it doesn't depend on rho zero. As long as I put initial conditions in this oscillatory regime, it does not depend on the exact density where I put it. So the main argument for putting the initial condition at the bounds is because this is the only unique density, it's singled out. But here I don't need to have a precise density. I just put it somewhere in this regime. I don't need to know exactly when the scalar field is created or if it's created or whatever it is. So then I evolved this with the full equations. And now I use the mass from the suggested by the W map. And I get this. So this is N is number E fold. This is number E fold as a function of this angle delta. And here is the resulting probability distribution. And as you see, I get enough inflation. It's more than 65 E fold. And it's also very peaked. It doesn't look very peaked if you just see this. But just to give you some references, this is the maximum number of E folds allowed by the theory. So So this is, you get anything up to this if you put initial condition at the bounds. And compared to that, that this is a very, very narrow distribution. And since we had a previous talk today that used this value, XB, I throw in this plot. So it was the first speaker of the day. I'm bad with names. He said if it was about somewhere here, he would have observable predictions. So maybe with some other inflation, there's hope it's not too different. Okay, I should hurry up a bit. So these results depends on the critical density, which means that I can also turn this around and say that, all right, how can I vary the critical density and still have enough number of e-folds? So the predictions we have right now is the Barberis parameter is calculated from black hole entropy and the critical density. Use some minimum area argument, and then you calculate it from the Barberis parameter. No one has measured these, so it would be nice to have some independent predictions. I can't make predictions. I can make constraints, which is better than nothing. So if I say that I need that this analysis that I just showed you, I wanted to produce a probability of that the number of e-folds of inflation is larger than 65 with whatever confidence interval you want, then I can put lower constraints on the critical density or upper constraints on the Barberis-emitted parameter. So, just to summarize, if we put initial conditions at the bounds, we get a lot of inflation, completely arbitrary length, and this is not unique for loop quantum cosmology. It just has to do that inflation is a tractor, and if you put initial condition before the inflation, you will get inflation because it's an attractor. But if you put arbitrary conditions in the pre-inflationary area in this oscillationary phase, we get enough p-folds, at least in this model, and we also get a very peaked probability, so we actually know what is our observable window for perturbations, which is what we can see, as we heard in the last talk. Yeah, and that's all.
Questions?
How robust are the predictions for the number of e-folds if you change the potential, if you look at different types of inflation? Have you looked at that?
I haven't tested other. I tested a bit with a 5-4 potential, which is ruled out, but just to see something else. And qualitatively, it was the same. And I expect that qualitatively, it will be the same for any inflation that any inflatory potential, because inflatory potential has to share certain features. But I haven't done the, I don't have any quantitatively results.
So this is a naive question. So you are assuming that during the contracting branch, the inflaton field evolves freely. So there is no interactions with the particles of the standard model. And we know that in a realistic model, they should be because we have reheating. And so do you think that that is a good approximation in the past branch during the whole evolution from the infinity until the bounds? Or do you have anything to say?
If we look at this picture. So we in the standard inflation, we start about here. No, actually not. It starts about here. Sorry. So in the standard inflation, we assume that interaction with the rest of the matter that we have is neglectable here, and something happens here in the reheating. And so the only thing I'm assuming is that the laws of physics are the same. I mean, that we have a... Okay, maybe... I'm assuming that it's similar things in the past, so that on... so that the... So we... That only... not until we reach this density in here in the past, that's when we get... So... Maybe the, so here I put my initial conditions somewhere here. And this is where we can assume to have interaction with other matter. There's a lot of uncertainty. I have no idea what's going on. And that's why I put random initial conditions here. So I don't have to assume that this goes back all the way to past infinity. I mean, the initial conditions that I use works even if I put them here or in here, Did you understand my answer? So I only assume that I don't have okay, for this equation to hold, I assume that I don't have interaction with the rest of the matter field. And I assume that this holds during this bit of the evolution, but at the same density where reheating is expected to happen, I don't assume anything. Because it's exactly here where I put my random initial conditions. And putting random initial conditions is a way to mathematically describe my ignorance. Okay. Second try, I got it.
Okay, let's thank Linda again. Our last speaker is Andrea Dapor.
Oh.
Okay, Andrea will speak about quantum field theory on quantum space-time.
Yes, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I hope so.
So I'd like to thank the organizer for giving me the opportunity of reporting about my recent work, which I've been doing in collaboration with Professor Lewandowski and Jacek Puchta. And if you're interested, you can find basically everything I will be saying today. You can find this in these two papers. So a word about the title. It's quite fancy and it's designed to attract attention, but maybe it should be quantum field theory in quantum space-time, a couple of remarks. Okay. Why is that? Because, basically these are the two remarks I will be doing, but let me go to motivation. So the motivation of this talk is basically to answer two questions about quantum field theory on a cosmological quantum space-time. You have been attending the sessions, the plenary sessions this morning, and so you notice that there is quite some interest in quantizing cosmological perturbations on a quantum space-time, mainly of the loop quantum type, but I will try to show you that my analysis works in more generical cases. And the two questions I would like to answer, or at least try to answer, is they are the which phase space variables should we actually quantize in light of a canonical canonical approach to quantization? And the second question maybe is a bit more technical, but it is maybe more interesting from the physical point of view. I hope to convince you about this. Is which Drest metric should we actually use in the case of massive fields, or more generically, fields with a potential? Okay, for example, the inflaton. So let's start. The full theory I am considering is just a general relativity plus two scalar fields, both with potential. Why I choose two of them? Well, because one is going to play the role of time through deparameterization, which is a very popular way of describing, let's say, solving the problem of time in general relativity. And the other one will be, so this is T, the clock field, and the other one will be playing the role of a test field, let's say, just two. So if you like, you can think, if you like that the inflaton plays the role of time, then you can just retain this part here. And instead, if you want the inflaton to be just a test field, you will use this. But you will see that there is not big difference. So after performing an ADM canonical analysis, we have that the phase space splits in the three sectors, geometry, clock field, and the matter part. These are just the degrees of freedom, I'm just to fix the notation. And of course, we have the constraints of general relativity. So this was well known. And now, how is the construction which we perform? Well, first of all, we have to fix the topology of the spatial surface. And we choose torus because we later will be performing a Fourier transform. So this is just a convenient choice. After this, we have to somehow define our homogeneous and isotropic sector of the theory. So this is done here. So I just basically, if you look, for example, take a look at the homogeneous part. So this variable here is just the homogeneous part of the clock field, and it will be actually used to play the role of time. And for example, alpha, as well, you can see more or less easily, it's just the logarithm of the scale factor. So in this way, given a generic metric and generic non-homogeneous clock fields, we can extract the homogeneous isotropic part. And of course, we have to define also the rest, which is exactly the rest, right? We define, we take the full fields and remove what we introduced here. And this is the rest. Don't be fooled by the fact that there is a delta here. These are not small quantities. This you can always do for every point in phase space. You can always just define coordinates on phase space such that they separate the homogeneous isotropic part and the inhomogeneities. Okay? Of course, later we will be considering small inhomogeneities, and therefore that's why there is the delta. But up to now, everything is generic. So then you perform a Fourier transformation, which basically means that instead of x, there will be a k attached to all fields. And I denote the Fourier transform with this hat. So this is just for you to know. And then for another technical thing, we will be splitting the geometrical sector into its scalar, vector, and tensor modes. You are probably familiar with the graviton. Well, this is the tensor mode. So this is, at the end, it's just a canonical transformation on the phase space. So you have a canonical algebra between the background variables and a canonical algebra between the perturbations. And of course, this M goes from 1 to 6, and it's the scalar sector, 1, 2, vector sector, 3, 4, and tensor sector, 5, 6. So at this point, we perform this Taylor expansion. So at this point, this delta R small. We expand in particular the constraints as function on the phase space. We can do this. And we are left up to linear order with these constraints here. This guy here constrains the homogeneous part, and the rest constrain the gravitational sector. So we can, in particular, reduce to the constraint surface, which means solving the constraint. And there is a very natural way to solve the constraint for these variables. So the homogeneous constraint is solved for the homogeneous the homogeneous momentum of the clock field. And the other constraints are solved to basically remove completely any freedom in the scalar and vector sector of the geometry. Here I denote gamma free real degree of freedom. Okay, and of course there is an associated natural gauge fixing, which leads to the physical phase space. And it's again we remove completely the variables associated to this momenta. And for the homogeneous scalar field. From the homogeneous part of the scalar field, we leave this parameter free. So this is a real parameter because, we are going to use this constraint to define time. So without going too much into detail, just know that this choice of clock function and of the variables, it's enough to define dynamics on the physical phase space. So given any observable on the physical phase space, the dynamics is actually generated by this function here, which is, of course, the physical Hamiltonian. And it has this form. So there is a part which is generating the evolution for homogeneous degrees of freedom. And then there is there are the parts which act on the inhomogeneities. For example, this is the part acting on the surviving degrees of freedom of the geometry, so the tensor modes. And this is the part acting on the inhomogeneities of the clock field. And this is the part acting on whole the modes of our test field. So in particular, I want to take your attention to these two guys here, because as I said, I'm going to study perturbations. And these have this form here. So you see they are, okay, we expect them to be quite similar, but not the same. Why? Because, of course, this guy is suffering from the fact that we are using the homogeneous mode to define time. And so this is the reason why we get this non, I mean, this is really like a harmonic oscillator, but this one has some crossing terms. So you see that there is some term which mix this and this. So the position and the momentum of the modes. So now I can finally go to the questions. First question is, which variables should we quantize? And why am I asking this question? Because take a look specifically at the Hamiltonian which generates the evolution for the inhomogeneities of the clock field. So as I said, there is this crossing term which is making this whole Hamiltonian not of the harmonic oscillator type. So, of course, one can quantize the structure and then consider this Hamiltonian. But one can also wonder whether it's possible to write this in a harmonic oscillator form. Well, this can be done, and this is done by introducing Mukano-Sasaki variables, which you have heard many times today. And in terms of my canonical kinematical variables, these are given here. Okay, this Q and P. So you see that if I write this, if I define this P, this is just this guy here. So then I have just P square times the frequency Q square. Very nice. This is what everyone is doing. This is what Mukanov and Sasaki do. But from our point of view, this is not very good. Why? Because if you notice, there is a pi alpha here, which is the momentum associated to the scale factor. And this means that, in fact, the commutation relation, the Poisson relation between the scale factor and the Mukano-Sasaki momentum is non-zero. So this is really not a canonical transformation. And in light of a quantization of a canonical quantization of the perturbations and the background, this is quite a problem. Okay? So how to solve this problem, which no one seems to notice? Well, a possibility is to perform actually a real canonical transformation, which is given here. Of course, it involves also alpha, and which produces an Hamiltonian of this form, which is, again, not really an harmonic oscillator because of these exponentials here. However, one can argue that this Q is a very small number, kappa is 8 pi g, so we can hand-wavingly say that we can expand these exponentials and retain only the zeroth order because, of course, the first order would have a Q4 here. So in the end, we really get an harmonic oscillator, but with some extra approximation. One does not need to do this. One can keep this Hamiltonian the way it is and just perform standard quantization. For example, in hybrid quantization, one quantizes the gravitational sector, so the homogeneous part of the geometry, in a loop quantum fashion. And then one can quantize this mode in a Schrödinger representation and keep this Hamiltonian the way it is. So it's just not harmonic oscillator. That's it. So second question is, what Dress metric should we use? So again, let me bring your attention to on the form of this Hamiltonian. So now I am including the homogeneous part. So the full Hamiltonian for a mode is given here. And actually, this is the same for, if I take these exponentials going to zero, then I get this Hamiltonian for the modes of the clock field. Or if I consider the test field, this phi, which was presented at the beginning, this is its Hamiltonian. I mean, the Hamiltonian has this form here. OK. So what can I say? Well, in a generic quantization, thank you. In a formal quantization, I can simply put the hats. So I put hats, of course, on the geometry part and on the mode part. So of course, these are operators acting on the full Hilbert space. And now, as was presented by Ivan this morning, I can, with certain assumptions of disentanglement between the geometry and the background and the modes, I can assume that the form of this of the states is of the simple tensor product. So this nu is, for example, the eigenvalue of the volume operator in the case of loop quantum cosmology. And if I assume that there is no back reaction, that the modes do not back react on the geometry, then I know that the geometrical part of the wave function evolves just with this Hamiltonian here. So if I plug this substitution into the Schrödinger equation associated to this system, and then I can trace away the geometrical part, I'm left with an equation for this part here of the wave function. And this is the form of this equation. Of course, these guys are averaged on this state here. Okay. And now, what is the interesting thing? Well, for a second, let me forget about the potential. So let's suppose that the field is massless. So this is the equation. What is the interesting thing now? It's just that the same equation can be obtained by studying the same quantum field on a classical Friedmann-Ebensole-Walker spacetime, which is given here. So the tildes are to denote that this is not the same spacetime we started with. Of course, suppose that I have Friedmann-Ebensole-Walker spacetime of this form, I study quantum field theory on this spacetime, I get this equation here. So you see that now, if I identify this guy here with this guy here and this guy here with this guy here, the two equations coincide. So this is this n tilde and I tilde are the unknowns, and they can be solved. This system is two equations for two unknowns, so it can be solved. There is a unique solution, this g tilde, and this is the so-called Drest metric. Okay, so your quantum field theory on quantum spacetime is equivalent to quantum field theory on a classical spacetime of this form, which of course does not need to obey Einstein equation. Now, this is very nice, and it has been used extensively in the literature. So, but what happens if I introduce an inflaton, so for example, a massive field, that we have an extra piece, all right? So now if I take this inflaton and put it on a fixed Friedmann-Ebensole-Walker classical spacetime, the equation that I get is this one. But now I have three terms, okay? So I have three equations for two unknowns. So three equations for two unknowns, it's quite easy to see that there is no solution for this system. So there is no Drest metric in this case. Well, not true, really. There is a possibility. It's just to change the form of the effective metric. Instead of taking a Friedmann-Ebensole-Walker Drest metric, one can take a Bianchi metric. So now there are three. OK, Bianchi deformed in the direction of propagation of the particle. So if I have mode k, particle going in a certain direction, then I take a different scale factor in this direction. If I develop quantum field theory on this metric, I get this equation here. I compare it with the equation of quantum field theory on the quantum spacetime, which I got before. And now you see that I have three equations for three unknowns, because now there is also b tilde. So it's easy to see that there is a unique solution of this system. So basically, this Drest metric concept can be extended to inflaton, for example, a field with potential. But one has to be careful because the Drest metric that he obtains is not of the Friedmann-Ebensole-Walker type. And why I said it was interesting from the physical point of view? Well, because this is anisotropic, right? So different modes propagating in different directions would feel different metric deformed in different directions. So the question is whether you can see this effect in some experiment or if it's just a mathematical fact, but still is there. So to conclude, I hope to have convinced you that Mukano-Sasaki variables are not probably suited to quantization of the cosmological perturbation and of the background. But there is a good choice of variables, and maybe it's not unique. This we can discuss. And as the second question is concerned, I hope to have convinced you that the Drest metric can be, the concept of Drest metric can be extended to massive scalar field, to fields with potential. But one has, again, to be careful. It cannot just take previous results, one has to consider that this time it's a Bianchi 1 metric instead of Friedman, Robinson, Walker. So thank you very much.
Questions?
Just one comment, as Jurek said this morning, essentially there's not much difference between this our approach, apart from the fact that you're not scaling the perturbations, okay, by the scale factor. If you do that, the dress metric is characterized only by the square of the scale factor, just by one quantity. Then if you include the inflaton, you have two expectation values with two equations, okay? So you don't have the problem of going to the anisotropic metrics, and you can do exactly the same, okay?
Okay.
Any other question or comment? Yeah.
I have several questions, but let me ask first one. So you were observing that you cannot fit, you cannot have the dress metric using Friedman-Robinson-Walker metric. So you were considering a more generic one,
mm-hmm.
and you were considering a Bianchi metric in which one direction and the two others are different. Can you choose any other form of the metric?
Yes, I would say that is a very good question. And in principle, the reason why we chose Bianchi 1 is because it's the easiest generalization of the Friedman-Robinson-Walker, and it preserves the symmetry of the system. Because now the system is not anymore spherically symmetric. You are considering a specific mode in a specific direction. So you have this cylindrical symmetry. So the simplest metric which preserves the symmetry of the system is this Bianchi one deformed in one direction. But in principle, you're right that one can. I mean, I expect that if one considers even more complicated fields, for example, if you take into account other fields of the standard model, then you will have many more equations to be satisfied, and so your dress metric will be more and more complicated. So yes.
And second question is that I was lost with the logics at some point because I think you getting troubles because you, as you said at the beginning, you were considering perturbations, and they are not purely inhomogeneous in general, so they can be just generic. So there is not a clear split between background and perturbations, and that was manifest in the fact that the Poisson brackets between background and perturbations was not zero.
If I understand your question, Okay.
But at some point you made some approximation in which so you had a nonlinear equation for this delta Q and can you go back? Over here. So you have this Hamiltonian which is highly nonlinear,
yes.
In Q because there is exponential, and you were approximating it just by the first term, so forgetting about non-linear terms. So initially you had non-negligible back reaction between perturbations and the background, because
mm-hmm.
the Poisson brackets was not zero, and now you are making some approximation to get rid of that.
The situation you have with Mukano Sasaki variables. Okay, because this is not a canonical transformation. I mean, if I define just Q in this form and P in this form, and I don't touch the homogeneous variables, then this is not a canonical transformation, okay? So then you have this situation. But with this canonical transformation, I am modifying the background. So indeed, this is a canonical transformation, this is a canonical transformation, and this is the Hamiltonian for
but
it.
There is a mixture between background and
yes,
background.
Yeah, that's
so you are mixing everything. And I mean, that is fine. That is just more complicated. And I'm saying this because if you choose, as I did in my talk, perturbations as purely inhomogeneous, so they are just different from the background, they cannot be mixture between one is homogeneous and the other one is inhomogeneous, so it is clear what is background and what is perturbation, then even if you consider the inflaton field with a mass and you consider scalar perturbations and the mass of the inflaton is around, you can have a dress metric with a Freeman Robertson Walker form.
Oh, so no. This is, I sorry, maybe it was not clear, you see. For example, let's consider this, where is it? Okay. Let's consider the test field, okay? So let's forget about this. We will be using this as time, but let's consider the test field, okay? Let's take a look at the test field. How is it Hamiltonian? So for the test field, these two variables are canonically conjugated and they commute with everything. Okay, so this is the best of the situation, like what you are saying. What is the form of the Hamiltonian for this field? It's here, and you see that this potential is still here. So if you have a mass, so you still have these three terms. So this is exactly what I was saying here. That this form of the Hamiltonian is the same for both the cases. I mean, if you want to be careful, if you want to introduce the exponentials in the case of a inflaton clock field, then here you have some exponentials. But if you forget about the inflaton, I mean, if you forget about the clock field, then you think of the inflaton as this test field, then this is the form of the Hamiltonian, but you still have this term here. So you really cannot solve this system.
Why is it different from what we?
I got the impression that during your talk you were not. I mean, you were really putting this equal to zero. I didn't see in the equation of motion of the modes of your field. There was no potential.
In our analysis, there is a V prime prime. Maybe I didn't write it explicitly in the equations because I was just writing.
Okay, but maybe we can discuss this because
can I make a comment about that? I think the difference is that he completes a canonical transformation so that he has a symplectic structure, and he quantizes the system with a symplectic structure. But since you didn't complete the canonical transformation because you want to do really this splitting between your perturbations and the background, you don't have a Hamiltonian system, right? You explained us this morning that.
Right, but
I think that's the main difference between the two approaches. I might be wrong. Maybe you want to comment more.
Yeah, I mean,
right. And this is my point that but by not assuming perturbations as purely inhomogeneous, you get some mixture between background and perturbations, which produces difficulties.
No, yeah. But in this case, these guys are completely inhomogeneous.
So then. The analysis should be identical to what they presented. I don't see why they should be different.
Yeah, your system of variables is different, and you don't have a symplectic structure for the whole system. Do you? I understood this morning from your talk that you have a Hamiltonian with two different terms, but you cannot understand those as, I don't remember exactly, but you saw this morning that we cannot see those as coming from the same vector?
A single Hamiltonian, but I think here is the same. Maybe there are some. I am trying to see what are the differences. And
your phase space is different, and yeah. You don't have commutation relations with your variable.
But if the perturbations are purely inhomogeneous, it should be the same. I don't
see. So I think we should take a look at the exact, I mean, all the details of the analysis of both the approaches, yes.